Radio.
You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.
Hello and welcome to Truth Will Out Radio. Today's date is the 7th of April 2017 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks. Normally we would have Dennis Wise here, the producer of Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told. But last week his computer went kaput. He managed to get a message to me on the Friday saying that the computer, or on the Thursday night, I think it was, saying that the computer had completely crashed. He had to order a new one. He actually lost the whole of the week's work. He'd been working on the new video, working on the new documentary series, and he actually lost all of that. And he was expecting a new computer to arrive last Friday. And that was the last that I've heard from him. So I am guessing that the new computer has not yet arrived. There's been no new content on his YouTube channel. Hopefully he'll be here for next week. But we didn't want to leave you, the listeners, without something something for you to think about on a Friday night. So I've invited Schmidt on today, Messerschmidt from Schmidt's Axis War Hero series that you've also heard on here on Truth Without Radio. He kindly accepted to come on tonight. And we're going to discuss a few of the things that are in the news and a few other subjects. And if anyone in the chat room has any ideas of things that they'd like us to talk about, then just drop them in the chat room. So, Schmidt, how are you doing today?
I'm doing quite all right. It was an interesting day, wasn't it, with all the news coming in. And at first, it didn't start off so well. I felt kind of gloomy. Then I went into the chat room to see what people were thinking about the news. And someone came in and asked me to please give him a white pill. And so I ended up trying to cheer up people, and that in turn cheered me up. So yeah, I'm in a good mood now.
What was it you thought of then that cheered you up in the end?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question?
What was it that you thought of that cheered you up in the end?
Well, that's hard to put into a few words. We talked back and forth, and I said that, well, even if Trump has deserted us, even if he didn't live up to his promises, we will keep fighting because that's all we can do. And I also thought that it doesn't really matter that much what the overall course of the world is. We cannot influence that on an individual basis, but each of us can do their best to help the situation. And yeah. Yeah, we shouldn't be too troubled by what is going on, what we can't influence. But I think the words I used were the battlefield for us is in ourselves, to struggle with us, to do the best we can to help our people and to do better things.
That's encouraging words. I agree there. There isn't much we can do to change the outside world. We can change our own individual lives and the way we look at things, and we can improve ourselves. And then it doesn't matter if people let us down in the outside world, but so long as we don't let ourselves down, so long as we continue to battle against the vices and against all the things that we wish we didn't do, so long as we are continually battling against that and trying to improve ourselves, then we're carrying on that National Socialist spirit. And the people around us will notice that, and they'll be interested because they'll want to know what it is that keeps us going and what makes us different to everyone else, and just what it is about nationalism that makes people prepared to put up with all the insults and the prosecutions and the mean words and the horrible things that are said about us and the violent attacks. And we put up with all of this because we know what we're doing is right, because we know that we are dedicated to the truth and we are speaking the truth. And I wanted to start today's program by just reminding listeners about one of our courageous truth tellers, Lawrence Burns, the political prisoner that's currently locked up on remand in Peterborough. He was sent to prison for Facebook posts, private conversation that he had with friends of his on Facebook. It wasn't publicly available. The police stole his computer from him. They hacked into his account. They looked at these private comments that he'd made. As I say, they weren't publicly available. They wrote down these comments in biro and then used that transcript in court to prosecute him for being racist. Now, I don't really understand how they were able to do that, because I would imagine that that's not quite the correct procedure that should be followed, to just copy stuff down from a screen with a biro. And they also then went on a character assassination, basically saying to the jury, well, you should convict this man just because he's a nasty, horrible racist. They went through his life trying to just show that he was a racist, basically. And the actual charges against him were hardly anything. It wasn't a matter of actually proving the charges. It was a matter of proving that his personality was not politically correct. And they told him that they were going to really severely punish him. They sent him to prison on remand. He still hasn't been sentenced, while they do all their preliminary reports where they look at the life that he's had and try and find some mitigating circumstances for when he actually gets the prison sentence. But he's still in prison, and we'd like people to, well, we'd like him to know that we are still thinking about him. We are still mentioning his name. It would be great if some people could write to him. I have his address here. It's Lawrence Burns, and the prisoner number is A1796D. X, and that's Her Majesty's Prison, Peterborough, Savile Road, Peterborough, Cambridgeshire, PE37PD, England. So if people could remember him in their prayers, and also remember to write to him, because it means a lot to our political prisoners when they're inside, when they get letters. It means that they know that people haven't forgot about the sacrifice that they are making. And we have lots of others. Obviously, there's Joshua Bonehill. There's plenty of others that I don't have the names for right now. And we even had one that was killed when he was in prison. And the only reason he was sent to prison was for putting a piece of bacon on a mosque door handle, and he was given a year's prison sentence, and he hadn't even done 6 months, and he died basically, and we're waiting for a report to tell us exactly how it was that he died. And of course, our prisons now, most of them are half filled with Muslims, and they like to put the political prisoners in there with the Muslims. Apparently, Lawrence is holding up well. From the email that I received, a copy of a letter, it seems that he's discovered Christianity. So Christians out there, please write to him and pray for him. As I say, remember him in your prayers. They can't jail all of us. They won't be able to jail all of us. They're currently going after Jez Turner with a private prosecution. And this was for this was for the Shomrim protest, the Shomrim demonstration, and he gave a really good speech there. And at this protest, there were about 1,000 Jews all screaming and baying for his blood. And Jez Turner was surrounded by a cordon of police, and the police were there to protect him from this huge crowd of angry Jews. And when the Jews went to the Crown Prosecution Service and said, we are victims, Jez Turner is an anti-Semite, lock him up, the Crown Prosecution Service said, well, no, you're not victims. And no, he hasn't actually committed a crime. And I think the reason for this is that no jury in the land is going to convict him of inciting hatred against this group when there were 1,000 of them to one of him. And yet this pressure group, this campaign against anti-Semitism, they've got lots of money, they've got lots of contacts in government, and they have pressurized the Crown Prosecution Service to look at this again. They haven't said that they're going to take him to court again, but they've said that they are going to look at whether they should prosecute him again. And at the same time as that, the campaign against anti-Semitism, they are mounting a private prosecution against him. And if they win this private prosecution, they hope to then be able to pressure the Crown Prosecution Service into taking him to court. Because if they've managed to win at a private prosecution, then that means that the Crown Prosecution should win as well. And they're doing the same thing to Alison Chablow, this shady so-called charity. Is taking her to court in a private prosecution in the hopes that they will win, and they will then be able to force the Crown Prosecution Service to do the same, and they'll be able to say to the Crown Prosecution Service, look, you would have won this case if you'd have taken it to court, so why didn't you? This is the game that they're now playing. People have been found innocent. People have been found that they haven't even got a case to answer to. And yet, these bloodthirsty Jews, They just will not let the thing go. They are so desperate to silence all criticism. And they know that humour is central to breaking the hold that they have over us. So they specifically go after the people that are the most eloquent and erudite and humorous. I mean, Jez Turner, his speeches, he could be a stand-up comedian in some of them. Alison Chablow's songs, really, really funny. And they know that people that aren't actually nationalists yet are likely to hear these speeches and songs, and they're going to laugh at them. They're going to think that they're wrong to be laughing at them, because of course it's anti-Semitic or racist, but they won't be able to help but laugh at them. And once they've laughed at them, they will realise just how ridiculous it is to conflate making a joke about somebody with a violent attack on them. That's what these Jews are saying. They're saying that they've been, it's the equivalent of a violent attack on them to actually be criticised. And it's nothing like a violent attack. A violent attack is like what's happened today in Sweden with this truck attack. Today we've had a Muslim steal a truck, and of course he's then gone and done what Muslims have been doing, it seems like, for the last couple of years. This is a regular occurrence. It happened in London just a couple of weeks back. He's ran the truck over four people, killed four Swedes, injured 15 of them. This was done, I believe it was done at the time of the Muslim prayers, so that to ensure that he didn't actually run over any Muslims. So the devout Muslims would have been busy. And this sickening attack that took place this afternoon is just within 2 weeks of the last one in London. And we know what our politicians are going to do about it. They're going to do nothing whatsoever about it. They're going to talk about unity. They're going to talk about how this was a terrible attack on diversity and multiculturalism, and how we're all going to stand together with all these multi-faith communities to stand against it. And it's all an absolute nonsense, because if it wasn't for the multicultural community, these attacks wouldn't be able to take place. ISIS don't hate multiculturalism. ISIS love multiculturalism. It's only because our countries are multicultural that they are able to attack us. So when these politicians stand there and have the gall to say that it's our way of life and our unity among our communities that they hate, you just want to point that out to people, that it's only the fact that we live in a multicultural country that these attacks are able to take place. Schmidt, I'm sure you must have a view on this Sweden attack. I know that particularly got to you earlier today. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, I would like to, I would like to quickly get back to these political prisoners in our movement. Whenever I hear about these things, I'm reminded of a certain passage in the Bible, and this is Matthew 5:11, which says, "Blessed are ye when men shall revile you and persecute you, and shall say all manner of evil against you falsely for my sake." And as you said, this gentleman has actually turned to Christianity now, but I think without knowing, he was already on the path of Christ before, because he was trying to spread truth and speak truth, and Christ is the truth.
That's a good point. And,
yes, please go on.
That's a really good point there. You can say that Christ is saying that it's for my sake that these people have been persecuted. If Christ is the way, the truth, and the life, then anyone who is being persecuted for speaking the truth is standing up for Christ, whether they associate themselves with being a Christian or not. We should be treating them as if they are speaking up for Christ, because they are speaking up for the truth. And he is being persecuted for the truth, and all these political prisoners are being persecuted for the truth, and they're taking a stand against the purveyors of lies and wickedness in this world, and they're being punished for speaking up. So that's why we really need to support them. I think that's a very encouraging verse that you read out there, Schmidt. Sorry to interrupt you. Please continue.
Well, not at all. About Sweden. This is, as you said, we will see the usual playbook. We will see the politicians claim they are shocked at this, and even though deep down they must know that they are personally responsible for that, because they have enacted all these policies that have brought these people into Sweden. And then to stand in front of a camera and say they're so deeply shocked and then go into these bizarre lies that that they do this, that ISIS and these fanatical Muslims do this because they hate multiculturalism is so bizarre. But I guess it shows us the state our people are in, because a lot of people will actually believe that, as bizarre and absurd as it is.
Well, they just go along with it. After this London atrocity, they had a multi-faith ceremony in Winchester Cathedral, and it was for hope and reconciliation. And they had Muslim imams there, they had the Church of England guy there, they had the Sikhs there, they had a Sikh woman there, they had Jewish rabbi there, and they had the priest himself, the Church of England priest, was saying that all these religions have in common the Book of Psalms, which is a blatant lie. The Jews don't follow the Book of Psalms. They don't have the Book of Psalms in their Talmud. They don't have the Book of Psalms in their Torah, which is the first five books of the Bible. And the Muslims don't follow the Book of Psalms either. They don't have anything to do with the Psalms in the Quran. I don't think they've mentioned King David in the Quran. The Psalms were written by King David, and he was a big inspiration of King Alfred the Great. King Alfred the Great, one of the greatest British kings, he translated the Book of Psalms into from Latin into Old English, and he made certain that this copy of the Book of Psalms was sent out to all the major cities in England, and he wrote a preface to every one of these psalms. And a lot of them are battle hymns. They're about going out against the enemy and slaughtering the enemy and calling for God's help in defeating the enemies of God. And there's none of this turn the other cheek to the enemies of God. None of this love the enemies of God, love the Jews, love the Muslims. None of that. It's all about wiping them out entirely and calling down the vengeance of God upon these people that are attacking our people. I mean, at the time, their enemy at the time was the Vikings. And the Vikings were pagan tribe at the time, and they were pretty barbaric. Some of the ways that they would kill people, they would flay the skin off them and stretch them out in a bird shape to let the birds pick the flesh off them. You know, pretty barbaric things. But a lot of them became Christian, and they would become baptized, and they would then become a part of the British culture. And we've got parts of England which are still very, very Danish. The actual ethnicity is very Danish-looking. And we've got place names that are still very Danish. We've even got churches with images of Odin and his ravens in them. Apparently that's taken from an older church that would have been there 1,000 years ago. And the masonry from that original church has been put into the new one. And you can see that it's got Odin and these ravens on there. And Christianity united our people, but it certainly didn't turn us into cucks like the church tries to promote today. And with these multi-faith ceremonies, something like that would have never been heard of back then. I mean, the Saracen, the infidel, the Muslim invaders, they were praying to God to destroy them utterly, to utterly wipe them out and liberate the Holy Land. They weren't saying we should bend over backwards and invite them into our homes and welcome the refugees, welcome these refugees who can't earn enough in their own countries that they've destroyed. When they're full of resources, they can't earn enough there, we must welcome them into our country and allow them to take our women. I mean, it's disgusting with the way what's happened to our religion, that we've allowed it to be turned into the opposite of what it once was. And just seeing these multi-faith ceremonies, I mean, it really, really irks me that there isn't more of a rebellion against it. And we have nationalist Christians, but we don't have any proper nationalist churches in the West. I know in East Europe they have some very nationalist churches, and the Orthodox Christians are nationalist by definition, because the Orthodox Church has these various different national churches. You have the Church of Greece, Church of Bulgaria, Church of Romania. We have the Church of England, but we've exported the Church of England to Kenya. And we have Kenyan bishops that claim to be Anglican priests and part of the Church of England. So it's completely different, the Western version of Christianity to the Eastern version of Christianity. What's the state of the church like in Switzerland, Schmidt, do you know?
Well, we have basically two churches here, the Protestant and the Catholic Church. And then there are some what they call free churches, which are not affiliated with either. But the common theme is that they keep losing members, all of them. Well, some migrate, so to speak, from the established churches to the free churches. But there's a net loss of Christians all the time, and and that is not to be marveled at if you look at the media narratives. They are constantly anti-Christian, and not just in sort of philosophical or newscast programs, also in the so-called entertainment media. We mostly have these German-made entertainment shows, and even if even the, let's say, crime fiction, I don't know if that is the proper term, but where crimes are solved, fictional crimes. you would think that that is purely entertainment, but if you take a good look at it, it is full of anti-Christian narratives. This is, of course, for someone who doesn't know these shows, it may not be that easy to follow what I'm saying, but you can see these patterns. For example, if there's a suspect and you see a crucifix in his home, you can be almost certain that he will turn out to be the one who committed the crime. And the whole media is anti-Christian from my point of view, anyway.
You often have a subtle undercurrent of cultural Marxism in what they're trying to put across. And a lot of the time, it is anti-Christian. As you say, the Christian guy will turn out to be the bad guy. He'll be a wife beater, or he'll be a murderer. It will be a false faith that he has. He'll be made out to be the bad guy, and the Muslim will be made out to be the good guy. And it goes beyond that, and to having black doctors, black lawyers, blacks that are the heroes and save the day, and the white man is always portrayed as the weakling, the alcoholic, the wife beater, and our people just laugh at this. This is what really gets me, Schmidt. Our people just don't realise that it's a subtle way of demoralising us, and we watch it, and we watch comedies that mock the white man, and we will laugh at them because we think that these comedies have been made by other white men, but they haven't. They've been made by Jews, and the Jews won't mock their own people. They will just mock our people. I've seen them doing it. There's one that's on every day. There's a chat show on Channel 5, and there's a Jew that does funny voices, and all his funny voices are of different English types, different accents that English people have, and he just ridicules the British people, and the audience lap it up, and the audience laugh, and he's such a loathsome character, and it's always mocking the traditional types. It's always mocking the people that read the Daily Mail, the people that are married, people that have jobs, but the white working class, basically. And nobody ever calls him out on it. And the white Gentile presenter thinks that he's absolutely wonderful. And our people just don't seem to realise it, that it's all a way of mocking us and demoralising us. And before we know it, people think that we're not worth saving. They think that we're the bad guys, and it's better to make way for these other people, these noble savages, the noble Muslims, the religion of peace. It's not their fault that So many of them blow themselves up and attack white people. We need solidarity with them. The more we say we're friendly with Islam, the less the Muslims are likely to steal trucks and run us over. That's the attitude that people have about it. And our politicians are the worst of the lot. I mean, just before we went on air, Nationalists for UK passed a link to me, and this is about Wales. This is the Welsh politicians, and this is the headline. It says, "Turn Wales into the world's first migrant sanctuary." They want to turn the whole country into a sanctuary for third world savages. And Wales is a country that voted overwhelmingly for Brexit, to remove the country out of the European Union, and voted overwhelmingly to put a stop to immigration. And yet the representatives of the people, the heads of the Labour Party, the heads of Plaid Cymru are supposed to be the Welsh Nationalist Party, and yet they are the ones calling for this. They want to welcome every immigrant in the world to Wales. And yet when you look at the polls, there are poll results also in this article. It says that 70% of the people in Wales poll want controls on immigration to be tighter. Only 5% want controls relaxed. 41% think that immigration has damaged Wales. And only 5% think the effects have been very good. And yet these politicians are saying that we want to invite more non-whites into our country. We should turn Wales into a complete migrant sanctuary. And anyone that speaks up against that is decried as being a racist. Now, I looked at the article's comments, and somebody had put a comment in there, and it tells you all the areas where the white British school children are now a minority. 27 out of 32 boroughs in London, Birmingham, in Manchester, in Nottingham, in Bradford, and in 18 other major cities, white British school children are now a minority, under 45% white. So that means in 10 years' time, every one of those major cities is going to be majority Muslim. It's going to be majority these people that are stealing these trucks and running us over. And at the moment, they're still a minority in our countries. But just think the damage that they're going to cause when they're the majority. It doesn't matter if some of them aren't violent, if some of them are moderate and don't actually follow the Quran. There is always going to be a percentage of extremist elements among them that are going to want to attack the white man. And not just the white man. It doesn't matter what country they're in. If you look at countries that are 100% Muslim, if you look at a country like Pakistan, a week doesn't go by without a terrorist atrocity. If you look at Afghanistan, a week doesn't go by without a terrorist atrocity. If you look at the Muslims in Burma, they carry out terrorist acts. If you look at the Muslims in India, they do the same. They do the same in China. They do the same wherever they are in the world. And yet here we are with our idiot politicians saying that we need solidarity with these Muslims, and that's going to stop them attacking us. It's not logical, is it?
Are they idiots, though? I would say that if they are idiots, they could somehow be forgiven or just locked up in a mental institution, perhaps. But I think a lot of these, I mean, they cannot be that stupid. There must be some intent, some hate of white people and everything that is good. Or it's just greed, that they know they will advance their careers, they will get the money, they will get ahead. But I don't think it's pure stupidity. I mean, they also know that the majority of the people don't want it. And correct me if I'm wrong, wasn't Wales one of the areas in Great Britain that voted heavily for Brexit?
Yes.
So other polls have shown that people voted for Brexit because they wanted immigration to go down or to stop altogether. So these people know that they're acting against the will of the people. They're not idiots. They just, well, they're evil.
They must have a certain level of self-hatred. But what I wonder is just how many of these attacks is it going to take before people wake up? And I see there are some signs of people waking up. Millennial Woes did a video after the attack in London, And he was talking about Polly Toynbee, who is a liberal writer for The Guardian. She's a famous talking head for the liberals. And she was actually compromising on all the core principles of the liberals. She was saying, should we give guns to the police? Because that's, if the police had had guns in London, then they could have shot the attacker, and that would have stopped the car from running the people over and from him stabbing that policeman. And yet, guns to the police, that's anathema to the left. They don't want the police to have guns at all. They've been campaigning against guns all the time. They're always going on about how dreadful it is that the police in America have guns. And yet she was compromising on that and suggesting that the police should have guns. She was also compromising on the freedom of speech, freedom of privacy laws that the left are always talking about, how it's completely wrong for the government to be able to look at somebody's private emails or to look at the accounts or look at the browser history of what people have been looking at. The left are very vocal in campaigning against this. And yet she was asking whether now it's time to allow the police to do that, whether it's time to allow the police to take away privacy, whether nobody can have any privacy anymore. So she's compromising on one after another of the core principles that the leftists and the liberals hold. And I wonder just how many principles are they prepared to sacrifice on the altar of diversity, to convince themselves, to tell themselves that diversity does actually work. And how many attacks is it going to take? Because they do keep increasing. If you think last year we had, I've lost count of the number of vehicle attacks that there have been. But there was the first one, and then there was another one, and now we're having one every 2 weeks. I bet there'll be another one within another couple of weeks. You think this one today in Sweden? What is it? 4 or 5 people killed, 15 people injured. Last week in London, 4 people killed, 20 odd people injured. I mean, this one today, there was one report, it was saying, oh, there was a severed foot. You know, body parts are being cut off from the bodies of these people that get run over. It's a horrific way to die. And hundreds of people are seeing this because these things are taking place in the city centres. There was a piece of film shot today in Sweden, and you can just see the panic. You can see the people running. And it was the same in that one in Nice, where there was the picture of a child covered in a silver blanket, which the mainstream media tried to cover up. But the absolute panic on these people's faces as they're running from this Muslim attack. And the one in France, there was one attack in France, and the memorial that they had for it, the candlelit vigil, they put all these flowers out, and somebody let off a firework. And there was an absolute stampede, absolute terror, as the people that had turned up for the vigil thought that they were being attacked once again. And that's the whole French nation, which is on tenterhooks. Any loud noise could set them off stampeding in hysteria, thinking that they've been attacked. That's what this has done to us, allowing these other races to live alongside us. It's taken away our sense of safety and security in our own nations. It's taken away. If you think how much it's taken away from the adults, think what it's done to the children. The children can sense that. And we all grew up in, or at least I grew up, knowing that I was safe and secure, not the thought never crossing my mind that a Pakistani grooming gang might try to groom me, or that a Muslim might run me over on the road, or that I might get mugged by Negroes or enticed to start taking drugs at a young age by a Negro gang. None of that. I didn't have to put up with any of that. And yet the young people today, the children that are brought up in our white nations today, are going to have to put up with that. And they're going to have to put up with a fear of going on the underground, going on the trains, in case there's a nutter on one of these trains that's going to start attacking them, like they did in Germany. The unaccompanied minor that was given or taken in by a German family and looked after, then went out on a train with a machete and attacked all the people in his carriage. these youngsters that we are told we should feel sorry for, we don't know where they've come from, we don't know what family they're from, and yet we're told we should be taking them into our countries and taking them in, and our families that should be looking after white orphans, we're told that they should be looking after these child soldiers from Syria and Afghanistan, and then they attack these families, and yet we're told we should be taking them in, and we're somehow bad people for not wanting to take them in. We're racists, we're nasty, we're fascists for saying that white countries should be for white people. It's just common sense, and yet our people just refuse to believe it. And it's such a sad thing, I think, Schmidt, that the only thing that really is going to wake them up is more terrorism, isn't it? More violence. Because everything else has been tried. We've tried speaking to them. Nationalists have spoken to the public. For the last 70 years, they've been trying to wake the public up to what was coming around the corner. And now the nationalists are all being proved true in the prophecies that they came out with. And hundreds, maybe thousands of our people are being murdered by these savages within our midst. And yet still, we've got multi-faith meetings after these attacks. You watch and see. After this attack in Sweden, there'll be a multi-faith hope and reconciliation candlelit vigil where we all stand together with the Muslims, with the people that actually carried out the attack.
Yes, it's a sad state of affairs if you think about it. The state of our people. How did we get there? The other day, there was a story coming out of Sweden that a woman was gang raped in an alley and passersby did nothing to help her. And I think this is completely against the core of what we are as white people. And it has taken decades of media manipulation to get us to this point. I think the stories that are told to children and to all people within a culture are very important to form the character, to form a moral compass. And the stories that are told to our children and to all people nowadays are basically the opposite of what our ancestors, the kind of stories our ancestors listened to. Because those stories would have a moral, they would have a point and teach people something. But the stories that our people are exposed to now, as I said, they are the opposite. And it has taken decades to kind of sicken the spirit of our people.
I think you're right. Children young boys used to hear stories about the heroes that would step in and protect the weak and do away with the bad guy, protect the women from the mean guys, the thieves, the attackers. There would always be a hero, and he would get the woman at the end. He would get the princess at the end. That was his reward for being a hero. Whereas now it's books about two daddies, mixed race people, how terrible it is for people to hear mean words and racist words, and how sad it makes the brown pupil when people talk about chocolate or ridiculous things like that. And that's what they're filling the children's heads with. And on the other side of that as well, I think people are frightened to say anything. I bet the passers-by at that rape in Sweden, I must admit I haven't actually read the article that you were referring to, but I bet the passers-by were just looking at the floor. They didn't want to get involved. I bet they thought that if they did get involved, they might get attacked by the attackers and possibly by the woman. Because we've heard of people stepping in to try and protect a Negro woman that's been beaten by a Negro boyfriend. And the Negro woman has taken great offense at this, that a white passerby has interfered. And she's then turned on the Good Samaritan and attacked him. And so has the Negro. And in fact, we often hear of these Good Samaritan attacks in America, where people have stopped to help non-whites with a puncture, to help them repair the tire or help them with their car that's broken down, and they've ended up having their car stolen and been left by the side of the road, or they end up being robbed. because they have a completely different culture to us. The white man is used to going out and helping other whites, but so many times the white man has helped out the Negro or the non-white only for them to turn around and rob them. I mean, these Good Samaritan gone bad stories are ten a penny. You won't read about them in the international press, but you will read about them in the national press. And I can remember seeing tons of them when I used to do the race war section at the Daily Stormer. Quite regularly, there would be these Good Samaritan gone bad stories. So I would bet that the Swedes that walked past while this were happening were worried that they would have been attacked themselves if they stepped in. But of course, they should step in. I mean, that's what it's all about. Being white is stepping in and being honourable and courageous and brave and protecting those who need protecting, especially if you're a man. That's what it's about, being a man. You have to be able to provide for and protect for your family and for your wife. And if you see a damsel in distress, you step in there and you help her. And if you do, the other whites around you will join in. And I bet that is what was missing from those observers. They didn't think that the others would join in because they're used to living in a multicultural community where there is no sense of community, where you don't go out and help other people that need help because you might get robbed if you do so. I bet that's what it was, Schmidt.
Yes, and there's another aspect to this, which you already kind of touched on it. And that is the Millennial Voice actually did a good speech on this, the atomization of our society. People do not feel as a part of a people anymore, part of a group. They feel only as individuals. And if you feel like that, then you're much less motivated to help someone because your thought process will probably be, what is in this for me? And what kind of damage can I get if I step in here? And this also ties back to what I mentioned before, these stories and that our people are told, which alter the way we think about things. If you talk about how you feel connected to your people and how you feel one with them and feel they are an extended family to you, in today's media narrative, that already means you're kind of almost a fascist. And the brainwashing of especially the children has gone so far that there's a radio show on Swiss radio where children can call in and wish for the song they would like to hear. And you wouldn't believe how much of gangster rap and related stuff they are wishing for. And that tells you something about the mental state that they're in. And the adults don't seem to care at all. I haven't heard of any protest letter or anything that would have been sent to the radio to play these songs for the children.
Well, they've become disconnected from their own history and from their own heritage. When you have a multicultural community, you lose that connection. I mean, these different races, different nations, they have different body language, different customs. It's like the British people, we like our queues. We like to queue up for things. None of the other races do. They will just barge in. If the white British people are queuing, they will just barge in front and think that the white British are idiots for not pushing in themselves. And that's just one example of the cultural clashes that there can be. So you lose that sense of community. And as you were saying there, the people have a sense of self and not a sense of actually belonging to the nation. So they're just looking out for what's good for the individual. Is it going to serve my needs to go in and rescue this girl that's being raped? Well, no, it isn't. There's a risk there. I might get hurt. So I'll just walk off and leave it. Leave it for someone else to deal with. It's not my problem. She's just another individual. So what if she's white? So what if she's Swedish? She's somebody else. And that's the whole of this individual idea, this humanitarianism, that each individual is a separate ship and not a part of a whole. And all of that goes back to the human right to make as much profit as possible from the other human beings around you. And you can extend it from that to world trade and international law And you have a right to make as much profit as you can anywhere in the world. You have the right to employ anyone from anywhere in the world, whoever you can get to do the job for the cheapest. It's all about profit, and it's all about profit for the individual, which is the opposite of what we need as human beings to prosper and actually grow into real human beings. We need to be part of our communities, and our communities need to be based upon ethnicity. They need to be based on a shared blood and a shared heritage, shared ancestors, and a shared territory. Once you've got that, then you have a sense of immortality, because you know that the people in three or four generations' time are going to look exactly the same as you. You know that what the people were interested in 1,000 years ago, you're going to find that interesting if you research it, because they're the same people as you. They're your own flesh and blood, and you feel linked to them because they are a part of you. Whereas if you have a community that's just based on shared values, shared politics, that's not going to hold. That's not going to be enough to hold people together. Even Muammar Gaddafi knew this. He wrote about this in his Green Book, that political ideals are not enough to hold a people together. It has to be ethnicity. It has to be flesh and blood. It has to be family. The same way that you feel about your family and how you would die for your family, you would do everything you can to protect your family, that extension, it goes to your people, to your nation. And if you are then doing everything that you do for the good of your nation, and all the rest of the nation are doing what they do for the good of the nation, that's all going to benefit you. That's like everybody else in the nation is doing everything they possibly can just to help you out. And you, in your turn, are doing everything you possibly can to help the nation out. And that's the opposite of selfishness. When we just do everything we can for ourselves, it's not fulfilling. We can't make ourselves happy. Only other people can make us happy. And by extension, that's the role that we need to be playing. We need to be making the people around us prosper, and the people around us need to be our race. That's who your neighbor is. He who looks like you. He who is your same flesh and blood. That's what it means when it says love your neighbor as yourself. It means love those who look like you. Love your ethnicity. Love your nation. And protect your nation. Protect it from outsiders. Once you have these outsiders in, it breaks up the sense of community. Another video that I saw recently, a really good video that I recommend to people, Mark Cullett's video. He's been out in Latvia at the Legionaries March. And he talks there about how, where it's still 99% white, there's a sense of community. Now, I know what he means there because I've been there. But that sense of community you still have in the villages in Britain that are still white. In the rural areas, you still talk to everyone. You can have eye contact with them. People help one another out. They talk to one another. People they don't know, they talk to. They pass the time of day with them. And it's exactly the same in these cities in East Europe because they're still white. It's not a difference between village life and city life. It's a difference between multicultural life and a monocultural life. It's a difference between having an ethnic homogeneity and a mixed ethnicity. If you have that mixed ethnicity, there's no trust there. There's no unspoken words. There's no unspoken communication between you and the people around you. But if you are with your own kind, then there is this unspoken communication, almost like a sort of telepathy. You're going to find the same things funny. You're going to notice the same things. You're going to know that there is this connection there with those people that are around you. And I know Mark felt that, and he's not East European, he's British. Even though he's a different sub-ethnicity of the white race, he still felt completely at home over there in Latvia, talking to these Latvians. And the difference between having an all-white nation and a multicultural nation is huge. You cannot begin to describe it to people that haven't actually experienced it. So you can either move to somewhere in the country, a rural area in your own country, and discover somewhere that's all white, or you can go to one of these cities in the Baltics or East Europe that are all white to experience this. The other thing that he was pointing out, I think, is about the things that people would be discussing. They'd be discussing politics and these interesting subjects and talking about the state of the world. If you go out in Britain to the pubs in the cities, you're not going to get that. You're going to get drunk people talking about mindless subjects, mindless celebrities and absolute nonsense, because they're frightened to talk about anything deeper than that, because they'll get ridiculed, because the average level of conversation in a multicultural area is so low, it's going to be dragged down to the lowest IQ of the lowest non-white that's in that area. Whereas if you're in an all-white area, then the conversation is going to be brought up. It's going to be higher than you're used to. And you're going to be improving yourself just by talking to those people in that area. And this is the experience that I've had going over there. And he said that he was so sad to hear that the British people that went over there would just get drunk and urinate on the monument. And that's what happens when you have a multicultural nation. It drags the whole nation down to the lowest common denominator so that everybody starts behaving like the non-whites. Nobody has any respect anymore for anything. But as soon as you remove all those non-whites, I'm sure that it would start getting back to how it was. In the areas that never had any non-whites, it still is that way. It still is that way in the country. Now, I could go out to a rural pub and know that I will get a good conversation about some quite highbrow topics. And you wouldn't get that if you went to a pub in the city. You would just get celebrity talk. I mean, this is why so many of us go on the internet, so that we can talk to other white people and we can have an intelligent conversation. Because if we were to go out in the multicultural area that we live, we wouldn't be able to have that. And this is the important thing about Radio Aryan, is that we can provide that connection for people, so that nationalists know there are other people that think the same way as they do. And it's quite a few things that quite a few criteria that we try to fulfill here. We try to fill the space that's left behind when people switch off the television, and when they realize that they're being lied to by the Jews, but they still want to be entertained. So there is an element of entertainment to what we do. There's also an element of education to what we want to do here. You know, our hosts will, like you yourself, Schmidt, will study a subject and then do a presentation on it so that listeners can learn about certain subjects. We also want to provide information. We want to provide commentary on the news that people aren't going to get from the mainstream news stations, so that people have a different ways of looking at what they're being told about, and different subjects that they can then bring up when they're talking to people to bring them around to our point of view. So having our own media is very important. I think Radio Aryan fills a very important role for our people, and particularly you with your Axis War Heroes, Schmidt. And talking of that, how's that coming along? Are you working on a new one at the moment?
Yes, I'm working on a presentation, or actually the video, turning the presentation into a video about Adolf Galland, the famous Luftwaffe pilot. It will be somewhat delayed because I'm having some issues in my life that I have to deal with, that I won't get into here. But what you said earlier about being able to have good conversation with people in the countryside and not so much in the city, this is also my experience. And in fact, the Swiss German language has gotten a lot poorer over the last few decades, because people do not use anymore these kind of regional and ancient Swiss German words. And I think this has a lot to do because of the fact that we are surrounded by foreigners. We know that they wouldn't understand these kind of traditional and ancient words, so we don't use them anymore. And this has led to the vocabulary has become poorer. And this is sometimes even talked about on Swiss media, for example, on the radio. And of course, they will always invite some kind of quote-unquote expert who will tell us that this is completely normal, this is a process, language has always changed, and so on. But they would never invite someone who would say, this is a bad development, we need to stop this.
We get the same in Britain, especially in London. We have white people talking in this Jamaican patois sort of accent. Yeah, you've heard Sadiq Khan, who can't even string a sentence together in English. Well, you get English people that speak like that now, that can't actually form proper words, that can't form verbs. They can't add these endings to words. They can't actually form a proper sentence. And it has this strange cross between Pakistan and Jamaica sort of accent on the end of it. And the words, they all have to be two syllables or three syllables or less. You can't have any more than that. That's too complicated. The dumbing down of language is quite a serious problem that we have. Text speak has encouraged that as well. People not wanting to use long words anymore. And once you stop using these words, you stop being able to describe that certain feeling. So you limit the actual feelings that you have. The language that you have shows you how rich and varied your imagination is. If you look at African languages, they have languages which the dictionary is only 200 pages long. And that's the only ways that they can think of, is written down in that dictionary. And that's because they never had any writing. They were never able to actually write down words and remember what they were. They could only use the vocabulary that they could actually remember in their heads. So they had a limited vocabulary, and that limited vocabulary limits their actual way of thinking. If you look at the English language, you know, we have huge dictionaries, thousands and thousands of pages in a dictionary with words taken from Latin, taken from Greek, taken from French, German. When they're describing certain ways of thinking that are slightly different to the English word for it. And the more different ways you can describe the way you think, the better you can be at communicating with other people and coming to the conclusions that you need to come to, coming to the solutions that we need to come to. The better you can express yourself to people, the less chance there is for conflict, which is why you won't have conflicts in a ethnically homogenous nation. You don't get conflicts in areas which have just one ethnicity in them. Every conflict we have ever had has been between two different ethnicities fighting over one territory. You just have one people there with one language, one religion, and they're going to do great things. And you, look at what Germany did in that 10 years or so that they had National Socialism. They had an ethnically homogenous community that was doing everything for the good of the nation, not for the good of the individual. And it put them light years ahead of every other country on earth. It pulled them out of the slump, the economic slump that they were in. It got everybody employed, and it invented jet planes, magnetic tape, these amazing inventions that they came up with, all these patents that were stolen from them at the end of the war. And that was just one nation within 10 years, one white nation that was allowed to actually be a white nation on its own. And look what we did to it. But look at that example that it set for us. And I think we could end up seeing great things from Iceland someday soon. Iceland is still 99% white, and Iceland is somewhere that you are never going to see a Muslim atrocity take place in, because there are no Muslims there. It's that simple. You want to end terrorism? Get rid of the terrorists. Schmidt, we're coming to the end of the podcast. I don't know if there's anything you'd like to leave our listeners with before we finish.
I guess we don't have that much time anymore, but what you said about the African language or languages in general, I didn't know that until a few days ago, that some of these languages, or maybe all of them, have a very poor vocabulary and are not able to express complicated thoughts. I saw this, I watched this this man from South Africa on Red Ice TV, and he said that these calls for genocide by the Negro leaders in South Africa, he talked to a tribal leader about that and asked him, are these calls for genocide serious? And the tribal leaders told him, well, in your culture, this might be something like rhetoric, some nuanced thing. But in our culture, if he says that, that's exactly what he means. There's no doubt about it. So, yeah, let's pray for the people in South Africa, and let's hope that they'll be safe.
Indeed, and there's a very good lecture called African Language, African Mind by Professor Eugene Valberg that people should check out. It's an AMREN lecture that was given a few years back, and he talks all about the African alphabet, the African dictionaries, and what we can learn about the African state of mind from that, and it's highly recommended. Okay, Schmidt, thank you very much for stepping in there today. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. Hopefully, we will have Dennis Wise back next week for Truthful Out Radio. So, until then, have a great weekend, and of course, hail victory!